Member-supported Jazz 90.1 proudly welcomes you to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. America, and all the chips in the PC. It is Saturday, the 17th day of May, Anno Domini 2025, and you, you lucky people, you're listening to Soundbites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And it's 6 minutes after the hour for your edification and delectation. We are going to be bringing you news, views, things to choose, nothing to lose, kick off your shoes. Don't get the blues. Have you paid your dues? Here comes the news.
Dun, dun, dun.
Do you think I was ready? No, of course I wasn't ready. This week had this month's Patch Tuesday, which, as always, was quickly followed by Exploit Wednesday. Unfortunately, Exploit Wednesday seems to have preceded Patch Tuesday this month, with Microsoft confirming multiple zero-day vulnerabilities that are known to be under attack before any fix was made available. Make no mistake, with security experts rating the risk prioritization of these exploits as critical, Windows users need to act fast. Look, this shouldn't be news to you. Anytime Microsoft issues a security update, you should install it immediately, because within hours, hackers all over the world will have coded bots to exploit it. And bots don't care who you are, just so you get so you could get hit just as easily as anybody else. One exploit puts Microsoft's Edge browser into Internet Explorer mode, which means that even the rudimentary protections that Edge gives you are gone. A couple of others are elevation of privilege attacks, which means that hackers are now admins on your systems and can do anything. Oh, and did I mention that these attacks also hit Windows 10? Yeah. Let's not forget that after October 14th, any vulnerabilities will no longer be patched. You're going commando, baby. There are also vulnerabilities in Microsoft Office that can be triggered by opening a malicious document, so make sure you update Office as well. So our poll of the week at soundbites.org, that is bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you, is Windows under attack. Update now. Your choices are, I've already updated, I'll update now, relax, I'll get to it, going commando, baby, and so, Linux, you say. So far, we have 29 votes, and I'm already updated, it's just edged out, so Linux, you say. As the number one thing. And I know that you have, look, before, I know you have more to say about this, so you can give us a call at 585-966-JAZZ. It's 966-5299, toll-free 800-790-0415. And I know that you have seen this exact poll before, or at least one very, very, very similar to it. The truth is that every month, when Microsoft brings out the newest patches, we have Patch Tuesday followed by Exploit Wednesday. That's simply a fact of Windows.
And away it goes.
And it's the way it goes. And if you, in any way, shape, or form, are annoyed by that, don't blame us. Blame Microsoft. This is the way Windows works. Because they only update once a month, any exploits that are not fixed are now open again for a whole nother month. And like I said, the set of exploits that we're seeing right now came out before Patch Tuesday. They don't even wait anymore.
Yeah, so if it's a bad enough problem, they'll do an out-of-cycle patch.
Right. But
it has to be really bad.
Yeah.
Right. And they have to know about it. The fact is that the way this works is, we've talked about this before, it's a game of leapfrog. And what happens is that the hackers find vulnerabilities in the system. They exploit those vulnerabilities. Microsoft sees them exploiting. Generally, somebody else sees them exploiting those vulnerabilities and tells Microsoft. Microsoft then makes a fix, which they put out, which they wait to put out until Patch Tuesday.
And it may not be a single vulnerability.
Right.
They may chain, the bad guys might chain 3, 4, 5 vulnerabilities to start with. There's a port exposed on the internet to, you know, complete remote code execution.
Yep.
A takeover of your computer.
Yep. And so what happens is on Exploit Wednesday, which is the day after Patch Tuesday, the bad guys know they have an entire whole month before Microsoft is going to make a patch.
Many months before people install the patches.
Well, exactly. Yeah. And so if they find an exploit, they wait until Exploit Wednesday. Or in this case, the day before Patch Tuesday, because they know Microsoft doesn't have time to patch that.
Yeah, it can't react that fast.
And so they now have a whole month to hit machines. Linux is very different. Macs are very different. They get their updates when they are needed, as opposed to once a month.
And there are a bunch of updates just come out this week.
And a bunch
on
of
the Apple side.
Right, and on the Linux side as well. Some of them, like for example, one of the updates this week was they updated the Linux kernel, not because there was a vulnerability, because they put new stuff in it.
Yep.
Cool new stuff. So they updated the kernel. But there are also a couple of updates that fixed actual problems. And those were problems that were discovered, for example, on a Wednesday and fixed on a Thursday. And Thursday afternoon is when that patch came out. Nobody waited.
That's the advantage of being open source, that everybody within the community is trying to make it that much better. And they almost see it like back in the days when you and I used to be beta testers.
Yep.
Taking it on as a challenge to see, oh, that's let's see how fast I can fix it. And that's the way the Linux community is. They're one helping everybody.
Yep.
Because it is open source.
Yep. And the other big thing about Linux, of course, is that you almost never have to reboot. Sometimes after a system update, the kernel update, you'll have to reboot. But to fix a program, there's no rebooting.
Mm-mm.
To fix a driver, there's no rebooting. You just stop the old driver and start the new driver. And in fact, the installer does that for you, so you don't even have to do that. And Microsoft is working toward that. They've started touting that. They put an update you don't have to reboot for. Okay, thank you. We've been doing that on the Linux side for 30 years, but okay, congratulations. Good for you, Microsoft.
I saw a post where someone was saying that Windows Update, that means replacing the old bugs with new bugs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in a way that's very true. And I know that a lot of you don't want to be pioneers. You don't want to be the first ones to install an update. But when there are critical things that need to be updated, critical security flaws in the operating system, you need to do that update. And of course, it's not just the system, right? It's everything. It's all the programs you run. And one of the problems is, and always has been, the registry. Because so many programs put stuff in the registry, you often have to reload the registry to fix the old problems, because the registry just sits in memory. So that requires a reboot. And it's one of the reasons you reboot Windows. You don't have to reboot Linux. Linux doesn't have a registry. Every program has its own little configuration file. And so all you have to do is usually restart the program, which happens again automatically, and that reloads the configuration file. You get the new config. You get all the fixes. Everything's done for you. And it can happen in the background. You don't even notice it. Once in a while, for example, the other day I was updating, and it said I needed to update Firefox. And it said, Firefox is open. Please close it so we can update it. Okay, that's fair.
I see that in my Chrome all the time. You know, yeah. Relaunch to update.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's fair. But, you know, programs that I'm not actively running at that moment happen in the background. I don't even need to know about it.
And people don't like upgrading. They don't like changes. They don't want to have to reboot when they're in the middle of something. That's one of the reasons why there's still ancient viruses running around, Code Red and Nimda. Some of those ancient viruses are still running around the internet because someone's running a really old program. We had a customer this week upgraded replaced their ancient computer with a new Windows 11 computer. They're running Windows 2009.
Great.
They haven't updated their Windows in 5 years.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, and that's bad.
And then they want to run QuickBooks 2012.
Yeah. No. No.
Well, QuickBooks is an added annoyance because they've stopped supporting desktop programs. It's now
right.
Internet and subscription only.
Money dance.
Which is great for personal finance, not as much for business.
No. Right.
We're looking for... Yeah, we've got a couple very small businesses are playing with it, but
yeah,
larger businesses...
there's a number. And usually the support system for setting it up in business, because I know there's a couple folks, Alex over in England, and another gentleman... We're kind of follow the leads and everything else, setting it up for small businesses. I wouldn't say some big corporation, no.
Yeah.
But some small business, yeah, you could set it up.
Took them 10 years to get a new computer. We're never going to talk them into new software.
Yeah. I got to tell you, there's a comedian that I follow on YouTube, and I can't think of his name at the moment, of course, but he was talking about doing a gig at Microsoft. He said, I did 5 minutes of jokes and said, oh, there's been an update, I have to reboot, and I walked off stage.
Yeah.
He said, when I came back on stage, not one person was laughing.
You got to know your audience.
Yeah.
That's happened too many times. Blue screen right in the middle of your presentation.
Well, uh-huh. And we used to get that at RIT all the time. I would tell my faculty, I would send out email to them. It's Patch Tuesday. Please update your systems before you come in to teach a class. Because
mm-hmm.
otherwise, it's going to happen in the middle of the class.
Yep.
And day after day after day, Tuesday after Tuesday after Tuesday, Wednesday after Wednesday after Wednesday, I would get people calling me up and saying, what do I do? My system is rebooting. You don't do anything now. You wait through it. Time to sing and tap dance.
Get your spare
your class.
Enjoy your coffee.
Get your spare computer.
Exactly.
Load the file from your shared drive.
And I could do that, and I would say to them, are you running from the massive amount of storage we give you online? If the answer was yes, I could say, I can bring you the one spare laptop.
Yep.
But if you're the second call, too bad.
Yeah. Oh, well.
But that, I've heard on the other side, too, read a story about a clerk at a printing shop. Someone brought their computer in to print a photo, and a Windows update popped up, and the clerk started to minimize it later. And the customer said, no, you can't do that, and hit install. And sat there for 4 hours at the print shop, running the Windows update, trying to get a single file printed.
Yep.
Dang.
Yep. It's a...
Well, eventually, you can say install later, but eventually it installs
now. Yeah, it's
going
to catch up with it.
Which is why you can go into the scheduling, and in fact, it auto-schedules now for like between 2 and 3 a.m.
Yeah.
So that's...
The computer's on.
Yeah.
That's the problem we had, which is that the faculty would come in, not having turned on their computer...
Yep, all
since
week.
The last time they taught a class.
Once a week.
And they come in and open up the laptop, start it up, and Windows is going to say... Oh, I missed my update window.
You want to do
it
now?
I'll do it now. And, of course, they never hit later. And I would tell them hit later, and they would say too late.
Mm-hmm.
Single month. These people, and I used to tell my students
how can I stop this from happening? Don't hit now!
Right. I used to tell my students this. You have to understand that these people are world class in their field. Computers are not their field.
Yep.
And you have to understand that.
Read a story about a professor who called down to IT screaming that the mouse in his classroom didn't work and he couldn't teach his class, and you better bring me a new mouse now. So the IT tech came down, tried to hand him a mouse. I don't know how to hook that up. You do it. I'm not an IT person.
Yep.
So the guy... took the USB cord, plugged it into the back of the computer, and the whole class started snickering.
Yeah.
And then the professor tried to take the IT guy to the dean for embarrassing him.
Yep. Well,
that's probably one of my biggest gripes about people.
Yeah.
Everyone always says, I don't know anything about computers. We know a little bit. You're using it.
Right.
They're afraid they can't learn, so they don't bother trying.
Right.
I've just had a lady the other day that didn't know about multiple windows. I have to keep logging into my bank to copy data between my two accounts. Well, no, just make a second window.
Yeah.
What's that?
Yep. No, and yes, and my faculty, like I said, good people, terrific human beings 99% of the time. But that's true of everybody. The thing is, if you're a support technician of any sort, you only ever see people at their worst.
Yeah.
They're upset, they're bothered, they're angry.
I hope I don't see you again soon.
You're right. Right. And so you have to understand that they're never really angry at you.
Mm-hmm.
They're angry at the situation.
No one ever showed them that.
Oh, Bill?
No one ever told them you could do that.
Right.
Where are you coming from?
So we had...
okay, hold on.
We've had adventures with our faculty, but they're, you know, by and large, wonderful human beings. They just didn't know that, and they were in a high-stress situation. When you're standing in front of a class, it is really not the time to, A, point out that you don't know something, and B, have to wait around for half an hour before you can teach, because you only have an hour in the class.
Yep.
Yeah, and...
You want to turn your mic on?
Yeah. Too many kids don't want to even learn.
Well, on the kid's side, yes.
Matter of fact, last night, I finally realized, yeah, I'm getting old.
Finally?
Yeah, finally. I go into Walmart, right? And there's a young kid working there.
Oh, yeah.
And I turn to him and I says, do you have card tables? He looked at me like a deer in headlights.
Yeah.
What's a card table?
A table you play
then
cards
on. Then it finally hit me.
Now he's probably never played cards in his life.
Yep. I had to go down to the other end of the store. Damn, I am getting old.
Is there anybody whose joints hurt?
I found another gentleman relatively around my age, said, well, here's what we got, and it was over there. But it was so funny that it finally hit me. It's like, I guess I am getting damn old.
I knew I was old when I went to an event at Nazareth College from which I graduated. And the girl, the cute, cute girl taking whatever information I needed to get in, looked at me and said, oh, I know you. You're on Sound Bites. I said, yes, I am. My dad likes you. Thank you. Okay. Thank you. That's thank you so much.
My grandmother loves watching you.
Yeah, right. I'll just hobble into the room. Thank you. All right. To the phones. Our first caller is Bill from Irondequoit, New York. What's up, Bill?
I have an iTunes issue.
Okay.
So I had iTunes on my PC, Microsoft, and... on my phone. And I don't know, a couple, 3 weeks ago, three quarters of my music disappeared from both. I don't know if it was the same time or not, but they're both gone. Not everything. I think there were about 25 albums left, but at least 100 of them were gone. I have no idea what happened.
Do you rip your own CDs or do you buy music from the iTunes store?
I rip my own CDs from my collection because cars don't have CD players anymore. Talk about getting old.
Yeah.
You might want to try logging out and logging back into your iTunes account.
Okay.
That may help. It's possible that the save location changed, and so it's saving the files in a new place now and doesn't see the old ones anymore. You may have to search your hard drive. It should be in your user folder in the music folder.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can look in that folder and re-import that music if it's still there.
Right. Well, so in February, I had to change my SSD drive. It was too small. Changed the SSD drive, which I didn't do. My son-in-law did. And so then we reloaded Windows 11 because I was on Windows 10 also. And he had stored all of that data onto what is on my computer, the G drive. which was my two terabyte hard drive. And so I now have a 2 terabyte SSD that is my C drive, as well as my G drive. Mm-hmm. I have a portable drive for backup that's plugged in.
So what may have happened is when you installed a new Windows and a new iTunes, it put everything on the C drive because that's the default. If you go into your iTunes settings, you can tell it the G drive, and and then you'll have to re-import everything from C, or you can move everything onto the SSD now because that would be faster.
Okay. It just that they all existed in one spot at one time, and but then they all disappeared. It's weird.
Right.
So like 2 months after we did the switch on the computer.
It could be that you didn't update in that time frame, and when you did, it happened.
It's also possible. Does your icon still say iTunes, or does it say music? Because Apple's changed from the iTunes app to the music app.
Yeah, on my computer, it's iTunes. On my phone, it's music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they have a music app for Windows now, too. I'm surprised it didn't load with the new Windows.
Yeah. So they say you can back up your music onto your Apple Music account, which I don't have an Apple Music account. I only, I think, have the iTunes account.
That is, well...
But you have to subscribe to that and pay for it.
It gets confusing. The Apple Music app is free to listen to your music. The Apple Music service is a subscription service to listen to all music. They have a separate service called iTunes Match where it matches all of the music in your library to music on iTunes, so you can see all of your ripped music on your phone through the internet instead of needing to load it physically on the phone.
Oh, okay.
So that, yeah, if you have an Apple Music subscription, that lets you listen to new music, and you can save music from the music store while your subscription is running.
Yeah.
But the iTunes Match service allows you to match music that you have ripped yourself.
Got it. Okay. And then that stores it in the cloud anyhow.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Okay, well, thank you guys for your help.
All right, thank you, Bill.
Okay, we'll see what happens.
Yep. Let us know.
It's just like Microsoft naming 100 things Outlook. Apple has 100 things named iTunes and now Music.
Right.
And they all do slightly different things depending on which service it is.
You would think companies that have as much money as Microsoft and Apple would be able to hire someone who could make up names.
A new name, yeah. A lot of it's inertia. I think what happens is a new project manager comes along and they change the way things work according to their view.
Yeah.
And that may be fine for new users who've never used it before.
Right.
Which are there any of those that have never used Mac or Windows before? But for those of us that have been using a Mac or Windows for 40 years, you've changed the way it works and now we don't know where everything went.
Right. It's and that's true of any program.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when they add features, that's one thing. But when adding features means they change things around for whatever reason, that's a problem. And I do understand that. It's I updated a program this week, and suddenly everything was in Audacity. I've been using it for years, and now everything's in a different place.
Really? I better not update. I use that to process the show.
Well, yeah, and it's fine. It's not that I can't find everything. It's that my muscles go. You know, it's muscle memory. I go one place, and that's not there anymore. So, yeah. All right, we're going to take a quick break, but we will be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. It's 966-5299. Toll free, 800-790-0415. And we'll be back with a whole lot more sound bites right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Computer talk you can understand. More sound bites is next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 35 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. And we have Judy from Rochester, New York on the line. What's up, Judy?
Well, first of all, thank you for all you do. I am a member. And I'm now at a crossroads with computers.
Uh-oh.
Well, I lose Windows 10 security updates in October.
Right.
And I would like to maybe transfer to a Chromebook. But where can I go to learn about the Chromebook and what I would need to do?
All right. Let's start with what is it that you want to do?
Well, generally I do... I do emails. I do some lookup of certain things. I pay my bills online. I do some ordering online.
Okay, so anything that you do online, you can do with a Chromebook. Because basically it is a web browser.
Yeah.
Anything you do offline, like if you're running... spreadsheets you can do online and you know, the whole Office suite you can do online, but that will require a change if you're currently using Office.
You mean to use Libre?
LibreOffice?
Well, I use Microsoft 365 now, but...
And that's online, so you should be fine.
But you can switch to the free version, that's for online only. The 365 pay version gives you the desktops.
Right. But yeah, the 365 version has an online version. And as Steve said, the online-only version is free. So you're good there. So unless you run a program that requires Windows, moving to a Chromebook is as easy as buying a Chromebook. And
turning it on.
And then you turn it on and log in with your... Gmail account, and you can sign in to Windows. You can sign in to an Apple account if you want to. You can sign in to anything you would do online. You can do in a Chromebook
because
it is a web browser.
Yeah. Before that, on your current computer, I would put all your documents into Google Docs, so you can see all of those documents in your new Chromebook.
Right.
Okay, well, that's all well and good, but
there are
you've thrown a lot of information at me, but I want to know, is there a place that I could go and sit and learn about this?
Many libraries and continuing ed departments.
Yeah, within various townships have continuing ed programs that if you call, you know, your town or even one of the other towns, say. You don't necessarily...
I know we have them in Parrington. What town do you live in?
Webster.
Yeah. Try your Webster library. A lot of them will have seminars. Is there a Webster Community Center? I know like our Parrington Rec Center has a lot of classes like that, too.
Yeah, we have a rec center, too, but I've not seen anything about actual computer stuff on it.
Mm-hmm. I know the JCC does because I used to teach them.
Mm-hmm. Right. And there's also, if you go to rocktechage.org, rocktechage.org.
That's the JCC.
That's the JCC. They do a lot of stuff. They don't specifically mention Chromebooks there, but I would give them a call and see what they have to say.
They might be able to put you in another place that is doing that.
Now, what about that guy, Nick Francesco, that wrote a Chromebook?
Well,
I just bought a Chromebook. Help.
Right. And then there are lots of books you can buy at Amazon. One of them is mine. Mine is a little old, and I admit that. I wrote it years ago. But there are lots of, mine is called I Just Bought a Chromebook. Help. With an exclamation point. And you can find lots of books online and lots of courses online. And equally importantly, you can find lots of stuff in YouTube. If you search how to use a Chromebook on YouTube. You'll find lots of tutorials. Yeah.
Okay, my next question is, can I use my current laptop to do that?
To learn about a Chromebook? Absolutely.
No, to turn it into a Chromebook?
Yes, you can. You can do this in one of two ways. As Steve said, the first thing to do is to move all of your files up to Google Drive. Now, when you set up Google Drive, one of the things you do in the setups is say, anything I upload, convert to Google's format. And the reason that's important is because you get 15 gig of storage in Google Drive, but anything in Google's own format doesn't count. So I've got like 100,000 documents up on Google Drive, and they don't affect my storage amount.
Okay.
And so once those are moved, you're 90% of the way there. Now, you can simulate running a Chromebook by only ever using the Chrome browser in Windows.
Yeah, what browser do you currently use in Windows? Edge? Microsoft Edge? Google Chrome?
No, I use Google Chrome.
Okay, so moving to a Chromebook is 99% the same.
Yeah, so what you would do is run Google Chrome and see how many things in your daily life you can do just in Chrome without using any of the features of Windows itself.
Windows programs.
And many of those will have Chrome equivalents.
Right. I know somebody who owns a Chromebook and does video editing and sound editing all out of a Chromebook and all online. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. And then if you find that is comfortable to you, you could install a program called Chrome OS Flex. And it is the Chrome operating system for old Windows computers. But that would be part two of that, right? You want to do these things in an order.
And I've posted those links
so
on our show,
like
too.
I need to do some reading and some research before I even attempt all this.
Mm-hmm. So you get comfortable with it. And the YouTube videos, I think, would add that extra layer of comfort for you.
Right. So like I said, step one is see how much stuff you do on a daily basis you can do only in the Chrome browser.
Okay.
And that will and write down the things you can't.
Okay.
Right. And so, for example, I have to do my finances on QuickBooks. Well, as Dave will tell you, there's a version of Money Dance, and there are other programs that you can run online to do them instead. But you need to know what programs you need to find before you can go find them.
All right. Okay, well, I'm sure I'll call you again about this, but
let's take it one step at a time.
Okay, I will.
All right, thank you, Judy.
Thank you so much.
Yep, bye-bye. Last Sunday, every Sunday night at 9 p.m., we hold the Soundbites Lounge, which is a video chat. You don't have to turn on your microphone, you don't have to turn on your camera, but we take computer questions and we talk about stuff and we have fun. And it was either on the Sunday night one or the Wednesday night one that I do with people who subscribe to my newsletter, where we were talking about starting an online Linux user group. And I don't need to take on one more thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to take on one more thing, but I keep thinking about taking on that one more thing. And it would not be difficult to say, yeah, we could talk to people about Chromebooks as well. But I'm not there yet. Don't ask me where it is or when it meets, because I don't know yet.
It seems like Luger is kind of defunct.
Well, that was my thought. You know, there used to be the Linux Users Group of Rochester, but I don't know that it exists anymore.
Their last meeting notice was for April of 2022.
Yeah, so that kind of tells me.
Somebody's paying for the domain name web service.
Yes. And I would love to have that domain name.
Unless they bought a 50-year plan.
Well, right. Although maybe I don't want that name because I don't want it to be associated just with Rochester.
Yeah.
You know, who knows? Anyway, that's neither here nor there in the grander scheme of things. We're going to go back to the phones and we're going to talk to Fred from Rochester, New York. What's up, Fred?
Hey, guys. Well, it seems like every week you guys get me on a journey down a rabbit hole that it's fun and it keeps my brain working, but I'm the kind of person, I get my teeth into it and I can't put it down.
Yeah, welcome to that club.
Last night, from the time your show ended until about 2 a.m., I was working on trying to figure out thumbprint readers and get the thumbprint reader on my laptop working after I converted it to Linux.
Trying to get what working?
Thumbprint. A thumbprint
reader. Oh, the thumbprint reader.
Yeah.
So it has a fingerprint reader, and I was such a big hurry to get rid of Windows and put on Linux, I'd never even checked to see if it was working.
Right.
So I did finally get it working, but it took some time.
Yeah, there is a program called fprintd.
Yeah, that wouldn't work. It didn't do anything. Once I finally got the driver for the fingerprint reader.
Right.
So it's an older machine.
There you go.
I don't know, a few years old. Not that old, but a few years old. I found a YouTube that gave me a way to find the name of the fingerprint reader. I Googled the fingerprint reader and found out, yep, that's indeed, because the code that comes up didn't make a whole lot of sense to me when it returns, LSUSB? S?
Yes. Yeah, sure. The LS is a command in Linux that lists, it's the directory command, it's the dir command, right?
Yeah,
LS.
It took a while for that to sink in. It was like the next morning I woke up and going, oh, I know what that it means.
Right.
It means dir.
Right. Well, right. So LS is the list command, and LSUSB means list the USB stuff.
Yeah. So that name came. This name came up that I didn't recognize. So I googled it. Yeah, it's a thumbprint reader. There's a Canonical web page that wasn't a secure page, but I went to it anyway. I did get the thumbprint. I did get the driver. Then the fingerprint reader software app recognized that I had one. I put in my fingerprints and it accepted them, and then nothing happened. But I found out after, you know, clicking around everywhere, that in Linux itself, I don't need that software. I go right to the settings and user, and then I have to allow the fingerprint read, and then I go to the next page and it tells me to enter my fingerprints.
Nice.
Didn't need any of that. So that being said, got all that done. One of the things I found out was my on-screen, on the laptop, on-screen time didn't match what the BIOS said. Because I went to BIOS originally to find if I had a fingerprint reader, if it recognized it,
sure.
Which it did. So those two times didn't match. And it took a minute or two for it to sink in. But it seems that the BIOS is running on what us older folks called Greenwich Mean Time, which is now Coordinated Universal Time.
Yeah, UTC, yeah.
Or the military one that's CMT, the other one. Zulu. There's a military one.
Right, 24-hour time, whatever that's called, right.
Yeah, all of these things I learned as I was Googling until 2 a.m. But I did finally get it to work, so there was a list, although the latest version of the driver was 2022 or something like that. It was old. But it works. So, thanks for your help. I found also that NPass on Linux does not have an option for biometrics. but supposedly they're working on it because I sent them a message. To the lady who's looking at the Chromebook, if she's still listening, it's easy. It's easier than saying it, you know, than what you can describe.
Especially since she's already using the Chrome browser.
Everything she's doing is, yeah, that's what I noted when she was, I'm shaking my head here, with even nobody's watching. but, yeah, so, you know, to her, kudos for her for trying, and, you know, from another older folk to another older folk, you can do it.
Thanks. Yeah,
I have a question about temperature differences between my Google Watch and my Samsung Galaxy A52 phone. And I think Dave announced that it was 73 degrees at the airport. My Google Pixel Watch says 72, and my phone says 75. Is there any way to get those things to kind of like line up? I'm like confused.
Short answer, no.
They're probably all getting temperatures from different locations, and so those are the accurate temperatures from where that location is.
Right.
Well, that's the thing that I'm seeing when I Google it, but they're all set to Rochester. I thought, there goes thinking.
Yeah.
That they all got them from the airport.
No.
I don't know any local.
No, there's lots and lots of places around town that record the temperature, and it depends on which one they pick. What really annoys me is that where I live, my phone always tells me I'm in Brighton. And
okay.
I'm not.
Okay.
And so the temperature is usually 1 or 2 degrees different from what it is at the airport. And so I have one device that gets it from the airport, another device that gets it from Brighton, another device that I don't know where the hell it's getting it from.
National Weather Service.
Yes. National Weather Service, I'm sure. And they're all just a little bit different.
I've had as much as 10 degrees difference.
Yep. And generally they're closer. And I put that down to decimal points, right? One is rounding down, the other one's rounding up.
Okay. Yeah, 72 to 73 is okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yes, it can be wildly different, and it also depends on how often it updates. Because we live in Rochester, you don't like the weather. Wait a minute.
Yeah.
That's quite true.
Yeah. If you ever look at the weather maps on the news, you'll see different temperatures all around the state, and then they zoom into Monroe County, there's different temperatures all around Monroe County.
But I want to know is, why do they record the temperatures at the airport? Who the hell lives at the airport?
That's Central Rochester.
Yeah.
So I went to a website called Weather Underground, which is very popular for really minutia about the weather, and I can pick multiple different weather stations around Rochester, and I'm seeing variances in the temperature from 63 degrees to 74 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And a lot of places use Weather Underground because it's free or cheap, and you get a lot of them charge you for X number of hits, right?
Mm-hmm.
You get X number of hits for free in a day. And if you want more than that, it charges you. And Weather Underground is very reasonable in its costs.
So it's showing 51 weather stations in the Rochester area.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so you're really sorry, go ahead.
I installed one of the weather apps from the local news stations.
Mm-hmm.
And hence another temperature. But I didn't like that it was such a big footprint on my phone. I couldn't. So my phone came with an app that just has the temperature up in the upper right-hand corner, and that's maybe all I need at the moment.
Yeah.
Rochester, partly cloudy.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
And then when I want more, I click on it.
Yep, exactly right.
The weather app that I tried was a, took up like 50% of my screen space.
Yeah.
And there was no way to just minimize it to be up in the corner like a widget. Didn't have that.
Right.
So I don't know if you have anything that, so this Weather Underground, if they had a widget that I could just put on the desktop and say, okay, mm-hmm. I just want to see the temperature, and if I need more.
Yeah, I usually use weather.com as the widget, because that's, well, that's hosted by Watson, the massive supercomputer that won Jeopardy.
Oh, okay. Weather.com. I will look that up in a moment.
But, yeah, Weather Underground does have mobile apps. There's also a huge market in getting your own weather station. A lot of people have a thermometer outside their house, but you can get a weather station with temperature and humidity and dew point and the whole bit. I've been trying to get them to add one of those at our model airfield. So it may be clear at my house, but when I drive the 10 miles to the airfield, it's raining. I'd like to look at that first.
Yeah, exactly. I've had it be dry and a mile later it'd be pouring down rain.
Yep.
But yeah.
There are Weather Underground apps for both Android and iOS. The other thing you have to remember is the way it knows where you are is by where you are on the internet, the IP address you get. And that can be from
Syracuse to Buffalo to...
Yeah, it can be. It isn't necessarily Rochester and within 30 feet of you.
I've had that confusion.
Yeah.
Look at the weather right now outside.
Holy mother of pearl.
We've got cameras outside that we can see the outside, and it is raining horizontally right now.
Oh, yeah. It is in my house, too.
It's now the Weather Underground is saying that at the airport it's 68.
Okay.
Yeah. So, the reality is you're never going to get an accurate reading. You got to give that one up.
If the stick is moving, it's windy. If the stick is wet, it's raining.
Right.
So the challenge that I have where I live in an apartment. It's a brick building. I had an outdoor thermometer, a radio one that signaled back into the house.
Right.
And it would say, when it was freezing out, it might say 80 degrees because the sun and the brick building were...
Yep. It's 80 degrees on one side of the building and 50 on the other, because that's where the storm hit.
80 degrees on one side. In this case, it was 12 degrees on the other.
Yep.
I have looked out one window of my house and seen sunshine, and the other and seen snow.
We just heard...
That is Rochester, New York.
Mm-hmm. We just heard a massive thunder boom outside... in three soundproof doors.
Yeah, right.
there's a massive thunderstorm moving across the county.
Does WGMC have a weather broadcast?
Yeah, I think it's on the app. Isn't it on the Jazz 90.1
app?
Well,
we get the weather from Josh Nichols.
Yeah. Yeah, which radio station? Us, yep.
Yeah, I don't know that new content is available. I would like to download that. I don't know that there's weather on the app. I don't think there is.
Okay. So one of the improvements, speaking of the app, one of the improvements is I can listen to the app and minimize it. I can, before a while ago when I stopped using it, every time I would switch to a different screen while I was listening to you, because you'd say something, and I'd switch to look at something, and the sound would go out.
Right.
But they've since fixed that, so that's great.
Yeah. No, I don't see weather on it anywhere, although the cams are on for some reason.
Maybe. Okay.
Huh. I don't know. I suppose I should look. All right, thanks.
We have our own cameras.
Thanks, Fred.
All right, yeah, I'll have more later once I purchased a thumbprint reader and a near communication field reader. So I'm going to play with that when I get it, and then I'll be back to you.
Perfect. All right. Thanks, Fred.
I love you guys. Thanks.
All right. We are done with the first hour of this show, but don't despair. There's a whole other hour coming your way. Whole other hour of Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you, but only if you give us a call at 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299, or toll-free 800-790-0415. We are going to take a bio break. You do what you want, but we'll be back in just a couple of minutes with a whole lot more sound bites. right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Don't go too far, will you?
Online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
This is 90.1 WGMC Greece Rochester, a public service of the Greece Central School District and official media partner of this year's Rochester International Jazz Festival. Jazz 90.1.
Streaming online at jazz901.org.
Welcome back to America's longest-running computer show, Soundbites, on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll-free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
Well, I'm Steve Ray.
He's gone a week and he forgets what
I'm doing. I was monitoring the YouTube feed and it wasn't my turn yet.
Yeah.
Because it's a few seconds behind.
And 4 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites and we have Roger from Western New York on the line. What's up, Roger?
I'm going to try to help the lady with Google in Webster.
Oh, okay.
I'm not sure about the town and the rec center, but she really ought to call Schrader High School and the Webster Library, which I know for a fact has two excellent volunteers. I've used them both. They've saved many gray hairs, many or more than you folks. One of the employees of the library, she's there 2 days a week for an hour or so, and there's another volunteer who spends considerable time there, one day a week.
Perfect.
So the library, she can get that information.
At the Webster Library.
Yeah, a lot of town libraries have stuff like that.
Perfect. Yep. Thank you, Roger.
I'll see if I can find a link and post it.
That's good information. Thank you.
You bet. Bye-bye.
I don't know why I didn't think of the library. But our librarians, God bless them, and the volunteers, God bless them as well. The people who really keep the torch alive, I gotta say. They're good people all the way around. We don't think of those resources enough. Clearly, I'm just as guilty as everybody else of that. But the Webster Library is a...
Oh, yeah, they have a tech tutor list.
Perfect.
You can pick a tutor and a time.
Perfect. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Mark from Greece, New York. What's up, Mark?
Good day, everybody. Enjoying the thunder?
It's a beautiful day in my neighborhood.
I was not relating to any of this Google stuff, but I was thinking about why I don't have Windows 11 Pro. And I'm going, well, there's only one reason why I want it. And most people that I know that do want it for one reason, and that's for the policy editor.
The policy editor?
Right.
Exactly.
And I found a program called Policy Plus that works just fine on its own.
Oh, nice. Policy Plus.
And it doesn't need to be installed. It is a portable program. You just run it wherever you want it from.
Nice.
You can run it from a flash drive. You can run it from your hard drive. You can run it wherever you want. And it's light, and it's great.
All right. Excellent.
So
thanks.
So if anybody wants Pro because they want the policy editor because they won't give it to us in home, it's there for free. I got it from Major Geeks.
And Policy Plus works on home.
Right.
Okay. All right. Good to know.
Okay.
There you go. Excellent. Thank you.
Have a good weekend. You're welcome. Bye.
Yep. Bye-bye. And for those of you who don't know, sometimes you need to edit the policy in Windows to allow you to do things that you normally would not be able to do without specific privileges or whatever. And that allows you to change it so you can do things that you would normally not be able to do in Windows. And so, yeah, that's really nice to know. And yes, Mark is right. Often, the only reason people buy pro is because the major difference is you get the policy editor.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can use home without this Policy Plus program instead, that's great. That gives you all the, for those who need it, it gives you all the good stuff that a policy editor gives you without having to pay for Windows Pro. Very nice. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Bill from Gates, New York. What's up, Bill?
Good afternoon, fellows.
How are you?
I'm a pretty avid distro hopper, and I found a real interesting one the other day. What's the largest ISO for a Linux distro you've ever heard of?
Oh, good question.
How about 55 gigabytes?
That's the largest?
I just found one that the ISO is 55 gigabytes big.
Gigabytes? That's a lot.
Yeah.
That's a lot. What is it?
It's called Easy OS.
I wonder if that's a... an image of a already installed with all the apps.
Well, not just apps, but it has downloaded, it's like for young adults, it has downloaded what we would think of as an Encyclopedia Britannica of information in the download, and that's why it's so big. And it also has then links to on-site websites. So you can look up any kind of information you want, and it's probably in there, and it give you the link to the website. I put it in a virtual machine because I don't have a 55 gigabyte USB.
Yeah.
And just for fun. And then one other point, since I am on Linux and I'm going crazy with VirtualBox and VMware, I found that if you're on Linux, there's GNOME boxes, and GNOME boxes will pop up an ISO with one click. You don't have to go through all kind of remunerations. You just click it. In fact, it'll download some of the major ISOs like Fedora and Ubuntu for you and install it without ever touching anything. But if you're on Linux and you like the distro hop, GNOME boxes is makes it super easy.
GNOME boxes, okay.
I want to thank you guys for all you've done. I've listened to you guys since you started with Bob, and really like what you do. Thank you.
Oh no! Thank you. You're welcome. Thank you. Thank you. We thank you. We appreciate hearing that very, very much. Thank you. Oh yeah, GNOME boxes, nice. All right. Thank you so much, Bill. We appreciate that. Thank you. I'm also just bookmarking GNOME boxes.
Somebody,
you know. We'll see how I like that. Easy OS. Why is their logo a puppy? Was this originally Puppy Linux, which is one of the smallest Linuxes? What the actual heck?
Is it the same same puppy?
I don't know, maybe they just use, they use Blue Pup for their Bluetooth management. It's interesting. Okay, whatever. I suppose whatever. Can't argue with the...
How do you spell it? Is it just Easy OS?
E-A-S-Y, Easy.
Easy, okay.
I misspelled it, and I fixed it.
That's why. So I was trying to be too easy.
Yeah, exactly. I was as well. There are a huge number of Linux distributions. In fact, you can go to distroc.com, and it's SEA distroc, sea of distributions.
The logo is like 90% the same, slightly different.
It's a Puppy Linux, yeah.
Yeah, Puppy Linux, one of the ears is down farther.
Yeah. With distroc, you can test drive any Linux distribution online. I say any. I don't know that Easy OS is on there. As I scroll down looking for it, I do not see it. So that one isn't there yet. But everything from Ubuntu to Arch to the most beautiful Linux elementary OS is there. So DistroC will let you try them. Now, a couple of caveats. DistroC is slow. It's running on a tiny little virtual machine over the internet. Do not expect performance, but it does let you play with it a little bit and see what it's like. So DistroC is pretty nice. Okay, go ahead.
Before you go to the phones, I found that the Webster Library has a bunch of tech courses that are hosted by a company called Literacy Rochester.
Nice.
And so I'm posting their link too. They have a lot of different libraries that they host at. I know we have a similar thing in the Parenton Rec Center.
Right.
And I noticed I'm trying to find his name because he's done seminars at other rec centers and libraries as well. But we forget how much is at the library.
Right. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Gary from Macedon, New York, or Macedonia?
Macedon.
Yeah, I'm actually sitting in a car in a parking lot in Macedon. I live in Fairport, but so I figured I would say Macedon because it's more exciting.
Sure.
I get to drive from Macedon to Egypt every day.
Ooh, baby.
It's exciting.
Yeah.
I want to ask about word processing and AI in a second. I do want to mention before the break you were talking about weather and weather stations. I have a Davis weather station, and it's one of those things people say, why would you ever even use it and look at it? It's all the time, right? It's all the time. So, it's on my phone. Because I don't want to know the airport, as you say. I want to know my backyard. And they're fun. In any case, I retired about a year and a half ago, and I'm trying to get into writing, like fiction,
Sure.
So I have a word processor, and I have AI. And right now, they're not integrated in any way. They're right on the same computer,
Sure.
I guess what I have not done is I have not used a word processor that's like natively integrated with AI. And I'm wondering how hard I should try to do that. I haven't seen it happen. I don't know. What is it? Do you guys know anything about that? What would it give me? I could go with Office 365 and Copilot,
Right.
Not that I would, but,
right.
Go ahead.
So the idea is that you're looking at it backwards. It's actually AI being integrated into word processing. So it's the other way around. You start with the word processor and you add AI to it. And you're right. Microsoft does it with Office 365 and Copilot. Google does it with their online word processor and Gemini. And there are also ways to do it separately. Having the AI write for you is dangerous. And for me, more time-consuming than writing it myself, because you have to go back. I mean, I've tried this. I've played with it. And I spend more time correcting it and fixing stuff than if I had written it myself. On the other hand, when you're stuck, when you're staring at that blank page, right, when you've got writer's block, being able to go to the AI and say, here's my situation, what do you suggest next? Or give me five ideas based on this. That, to me, is absolutely the best use of AI. That to me is the best.
Well, I agree, which I could do without any special integration,
right?
Between it's just another tab on the browser.
You might want to look at a program called Scrivener.
I have heard of it. I have not seen it.
I hear from a lot of writers that love it because the writing tools it has for doing drafts, for doing outlines, for filling things in, and you know, like everybody else, they're adding AI, Mac, Windows, and iOS. And it will, they have a free trial available. I just posted a link for it. But it you know, the writing community just loves it.
Yeah, Scrivener is a great product. The other thing you can do, for example, I tend to use Google's Docs, right? I write documents in Google Drive. Mm-hmm. And in both under Tools, I think it's under Tools, yes, and in the upper right corner is the little star. You can immediately click on that and get help with Gemini. It will summarize your document. It will give you all kinds of right. options on how to use it. It's already integrated into that particular word processor. Similarly, if you use Microsoft Office, Copilot is being integrated into it. I think it's in 365, but I don't know that it's in the standalone word processor yet.
Yeah, I don't think so.
But I know,
and of course, they're steering people away from the standalone stuff.
Right. So yeah, if you're using 365, and there's a free version of that, Copilot Plus is in there. So and like I said, while I don't let any of these write for me, certainly I have used both Gemini and ChatGPT to say, give me 5 ideas on an article about, or 10 ideas on a blog post about, or, you know, that sort of thing.
You won't believe number 6.
You won't believe number 6. But that gives, you know, if particularly if you're stuck in writer's block, turning to AI for suggestions on what to do next is very useful. The 2 problems. One is you really have to understand how to properly craft a query, and that is an art form.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, all artificial intelligences lie. Excuse me, hallucinate.
That's a hallucination, yeah.
And so you have to be very wary. If you ask them for facts, you better double check each and every fact yourself.
Well, I've read reports where people say, "Are you sure?" And then they get a different answer.
Right, or you say that is not true.
Yeah,
and then you get a different answer, which may also be a lie.
Yeah,
and they will say, "Oh, thank you for telling me that."
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
but yeah
they gain all their information from the internet, and we know everything on the internet is true.
Well, exactly, except for April Fool's Day.
Why can't every day be like April Fool's Day, where you don't trust anything you read on the internet?
Right. Every April 2nd, I post a picture. It's a meme. It's a kid sitting at his computer smiling, and it says, "Finally, I can go back to the internet. Everything will be true today."
Yeah.
But generally, Gary, using it as an assistant rather than as the writer, as the author, is much more useful.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, guys.
All right. Thanks, Gary.
Yeah.
And enjoy. Right. Yep. And yes. And I have. Let me clarify that as well. Often I will say I will look at something I've written and it just looks clumsy, so I'll highlight it and say to AI, "Fix this." And sometimes it does. Mm-hmm. Again, not always. But sometimes it does, so it's less clumsy. and so that's useful.
Yeah.
Did you
hear the news that the people behind NaNoWriMo are shutting it down?
No!
They're...
Before we shoot back and say, NaNoWriMo is the... every November, you write a novel. An entire novel. And the idea is not to make something that's 100% publishable, but to get you into the habit of writing every day. So say if you do something for 30 days, it's a habit. And you'll do it every day. So if you write every day with the idea that at the end of that month you've produced a novel, you will be a writer at the end of that time. Sorry, so go ahead.
So, yeah, and so it started out as an idea.
Right.
And then a bunch of people made a nonprofit company to promote it.
Right.
And apparently those people are having trouble and can't find anyone to run it anymore, like most small nonprofits. Jason Snell from formerly Macworld, now from Six Colors, he took part in it every year, and he said he's written five or six severe thunderstorm warning.
Yep.
He's written five or six novels that he'll never intend to publish, but just the fact of writing them, getting your practice in.
Yep.
And so he knows several of the people that were involved in it and had some background history on a recent Macworld, but it may be shutting down.
Doesn't mean you can't continue to do it.
The national organization.
Basically, what would happen is you would say, okay, I want to write a 60,000-word novel in 30 days, so here's how much I have to write every day. And you had a chart, and you could put it online and check yourself against other people. And that's really what the national organization did.
And there was a lot of...
See your progress.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there was some controversy about it. People were submitting AI-generated stories.
Right.
So part of the point is you submit your story and let other people look at it, too.
Right.
And so that became an issue. But so the other thing you do in November is let your beard grow.
Right.
So was it November 1st? You shave it off and let it all grow back?
Yeah.
No beard November? Movember was that one?
November.
Movember, yeah.
I did grow my beard in November. I did.
Yeah.
In December and January and February. Yeah. But yeah, for people who want to be a writer, you talk to real writer after real, you know, people published writers day after day after day, and you ask them what should a writer do? And the number one answer is write.
Mm-hmm.
Write every day. And set aside X number of hours or minutes, whatever your process is. Every day at the same time where you sit down in front of that blank piece of paper and sweat blood. That's what makes you a writer.
Yeah. I just read an interesting story about writing.
Yep.
And it was this woman wanted to write the perfect novel, and she had three really good chapters, and she spent 20 years finishing three really good chapters.
Yep.
And she kept sending them to publishers, and she kept writing workshops and book classes and writing classes, and had every note anyone ever suggested in her perfect three chapters, until one publisher said, "Just finish the darn book.
Yeah.
Just don't stop and rewrite." So that's the biggest thing with November. You know, don't rewrite. Just keep writing. Keep writing. Keep writing.
Yep. Yep.
Let your editor do the other thing.
That's why you have an editor. An editor will come back and say, "This entire chapter stinks. Get rid of it." Well, I mean, you look at Margaret Atwood. You look at Harper Lee. You know, they didn't write a lot of novels. They wrote great novels,
mm-hmm.
and you can do that with the right discipline. With the right discipline.
And then what, James Patterson writes one book a week?
A book a week, Jesus crackers.
I love the scene when he was on Castle, the TV show, where he's teasing Castle because he only writes one book every 3 years.
Right. I suspect that him and Tom Clancy haven't actually written a book in decades.
Yeah.
It's like Lee Child. Lee mm-hmm. Child didn't write the last half dozen Reachers. His brother's writing them.
Yeah.
He said, "I'm done. I'm old, and I don't care anymore. I'm done."
The Scientology guy,
L. Ron Hubbard, wrote more books after he died than while he was alive.
Yeah. Well, who's the writer you knew of that had like 10 typewriters in a row and would write until they got
Walter
blocked?
Walter P. Gibson, the guy who wrote the Shadow novels. He wrote this is back in the pulp days, right? He had seven typewriters. Lined up, and each one had a different story in it. And he would write in one till he hit writer's block. Then he would go on to the next. Then he would go on to the next. And he would write every day until his fingers bled.
Mm.
Now, he was putting out two full-length novels every month.
And this is part of the dime store novels, too, wasn't
these
it?
Were the, these
it was
were
a dime
pulp,
novel?
Pulp,
yeah.
Dime pulp, not pulp magazines. And he would put out now they were short novels. They were really novellas, right? They were 40,000 to 50,000 words. They weren't 60,000 to 80,000 words. Still, He put two of them out every single month. He of the 300 and I want to say 28. Don't hold me to that exact number. 300 and some odd shadow novels. He wrote all but like 10 of them. They hired somebody else to do them at one point, and they weren't good. And Gibson said, "Why don't I just write those too?" And you know, he was paid like a quarter of a cent a word. But so what? Mm-hmm. He was putting out, you know, 80 to 100,000 words a month. Do the math. He was making decent money for the Depression. We should be doing that pretty soon ourselves.
10,000 words a day.
Yeah. So, yeah, he's my hero. And you read the books, and they are generally fast-paced novels. The guy who wrote the Doc Savage novels, he said, somebody said, you know, what's your formula? He said, it's easy. Every chapter ends in a cliffhanger that Doc cannot get out of. And then in the next chapter, he gets out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, sometimes I don't know how I was going to get him out of it tomorrow. I had to sleep on it.
Yep. That's John Scalzi's Red Shirts.
Yes. Yes.
For 59 minutes, we don't know what's going to happen until the magic box tells us the answer.
Yep, exactly right. So, yeah, writing is just a matter of writing. You may not think it's good writing. It may not certainly be great writing.
Lester Dent. 159 of the novels.
Yeah.
Doc Savage.
Yeah. Well, there's a guy. We'll talk about Doc Savage when we come back because he's one of my favorites. But we're going to take a quick break. Back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick. What do you mean, no?
We've got that special report.
Oh, right. Special report when we come back. Dan Lyon will be talking about stuff. Back in just a couple of minutes.
It's America's longest running computer show. Back to more sound bites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member supported Jazz 90.1.
Hi there. I'm Nick Francesco from Soundbites on member-supported Jazz 90.1. We're talking with Dan Lyon, Fraud and Scams Program Manager of Upstate Elder Abuse Center at Lifespan of Greater Rochester, Inc. Dan, thanks so much for being on this show. It's your great information. Thank you and Lifespan.
Oh, my goodness. Nick, thanks for having Lifespan on board here at Jazz 90.1. It's an absolute pleasure talking to you and your smooth jazz listeners regards to scams.
All right, let's jump right in. Sometimes I get a cold call from a purported government agency. How should I handle those?
I'm glad you asked. All right, so let's talk about our cell phones, because oftentimes most people have cell phones. Now, these scammers are going to call you utilizing a spoofing. And what they're going to do is they're going to spoof government agencies. Oftentimes, they're going to spoof the Social Security Administration or the IRS. They use these two government agencies on purpose because for many people, you start talking about back taxes or owed taxes, all of a sudden, the hair on your back of your neck starts to raise as you realize maybe the government agents are going to come pick me up, arrest me, and throw me in jail. Or to the Social Security Administration. Why does that become nerve-wracking for our older adults? You're talking about their livelihood. You're talking about their monthly income. And they these scammers purposely target the older adult with the Social Security Administration, and they're going to say, we see a problem with your account. And they use fear and intimidation. It's a tactic they love to use. So they tell the older adult, we are with the Social Security Administration, and we see that something's wrong, that your account appears to be off by some reason, and it looks like you're not going to be receiving your next installment here next month in October. Next thing we know, they're asking for PI, personal information. And, of course, you, the caller who took the call and accepted said call, you didn't listen to Dan at Lifespan and let that go to voicemail. Because had you let it go to voicemail, you wouldn't be giving out personal information right now to someone who's called you claiming to be someone they are not. These are imposter scams. And the government agent type imposter scams are the easiest to detect. Anytime you're getting a call from anyone from a government agent, Nick, there's only one thing to do with that call.
Hang up.
That's what, Nick? Hang up. That's it. Hang up. We know the Social Security Administration or the IRS are not calling you. Not in a million years. If either of these agencies are looking to make contact with you, then that will be through the snail mail, a letter in the mailbox. But this is always a red flag when you're getting a phone call, a cold call, and someone is claiming to be a federal agent. And, of course, Nick, they're going to use fear and say, well, you know, this is agent, Don, Mr. Sergeant Jones, badge number, 1970. You know, they sound so formal and so scary that people react to that. And we need to remind people that those types of phone calls are all about scams and fear and intimidation, and to simply allow your voicemail to answer and not ever pick up.
Yeah, I did take one of those calls once. One of the first things they asked was my Social Security number. I said, don't you know it? You called me.
Exactly.
Well, we need you to verify it. All right, you read it out. I'll tell you if you're right.
True. You don't read anything. Over
right.
the phone, never read anything out over the phone or give out anything over the phone on a call you didn't make.
Right.
Now, Nick, it's different if I picked up my phone and I dialed the Rochester Social Security Administration because I have a simple message or an answer to a question I'm looking for. I called the number.
Right.
Now, if the agent on the opposite end of the phone now asks for my Social Security number, I'm more than willing and should be capable of giving that.
Perfectly fair.
But not if the phone is received and I answered it.
Right.
That's the difference.
If they call you, they should know all this information.
They absolutely do know all the information.
Right, right. All right. Listen, there's a lot of this stuff we need to know. Are there any resources that are available to us? So rather than having to memorize this stuff or write down everything you say, there's somewhere we can go online that we can read this stuff?
Nick, I'm going to give you a couple of quick resources that are super easy to remember. Let's start right at the easiest. FTC.gov. Federal Trade Commission is the FTC.gov. Now, I want anyone and everyone listening to go to that website. Not only do I want you to go to that website and look through it, I want you to join. I want you to join the listserv for your Federal Trade Commission. The Federal Trade Commission works for you, all of us, Nick. They are the consumer watchdog for all Americans in all 50 states. So I want you to go to their website and join their listserv. You will receive on a regular basis, but not blown up on your computer, messages in regards to scams and or important information the Federal Trade Commission wishes you to be notified of. Here's why. I want you to join their listserv.
And a listserv, by the way, is really just a mailing list.
It's all it is.
Mailing list, yeah.
Email list, absolutely. Join their mailer. Get on board with the Federal Trade. Become their member.
Yep.
Why? We live in Rochester, New York. You get an email next week from the Federal Trade Commission. This email is explaining to you about a case they are currently seeing in Oklahoma regarding older adults and a particular type of scam and how the scam is being proliferated against said citizens of the United States. The Federal Trade Commission has been watching this particular scam, and they are now reporting upon it on their website, which you just got an email on. That crime and that defraudment of our victims out in Nebraska or Oklahoma, will it come across the country and eventually find its way here to Rochester, New York? What do you think, Nick?
I think it's 110% likely.
Absolutely. which is why I want people to join the listserv. Because wouldn't it be nice that when that email or that text message or that phone call comes to me here in Rochester, all of a sudden a little red light clicks. Hey, I read about this just 2 or 3 weeks ago. Now I know what to do. Do not pay attention. Mark it as junk. Delete it. Trash can it. It's a huge investment of time that you won't need to be taking anymore because you now know what to do.
Right. And they've got a whole government agency checking out these scams and giving us the information. Why aren't we just taking it? It's our tax dollars at work.
This is your money. This is your tax dollars at work. Now, not only does the Federal Trade Commission, FTC.gov, give you this information, but they're also, like I said before, the reporting agency. So let's pretend for a minute, unfortunately, Nick, you're victimized. You got taken by that romance scam. You're not sure where to turn. You're not sure who to reach out to. Well, first and foremost, you're going to reach out to 911. Yep, 911. You're going to involve your local police department if you, in fact, lost money. So call your local PD, report the crime to your local law enforcement. Next thing we are able to do, go to the Federal Trade Commission.gov and report this incident as well there. It's through their website on their homepage. There's a little red button that says, do you wish to report a fraud? And just click through the boxes. It's fill in the blanks. It's super easy. If the crime that your romance scam took place was utilizing a computer, a cell phone, an iPad, any electronic device whatsoever, then the next place I'd like you to report that incident to is the IC3.gov. IC3.gov stands for FBI. IC stands for Internet Crime. The FBI, they track all information fraud related, not only which is reported to the Federal Trade Commission, but they also want to get as much pertinent details from you in regards to the situation. So when you report to the IC3.gov, which is the FBI, make sure you have in front of you any and all documents in regards to this particular crime. If you're doing wire transfers, they want account information. They'll want the information on where you sent it. So are you going to be getting monies back from the FBI or seeing an arrest? More than likely, no. But if there is ever an opportunity that the FBI can collar someone here within the United States, there is the potential that you, a victim here in Rochester, New York, could be reimbursed. But since we're talking about New York and being a victim here in New York State, there's another avenue for you. Again, the reason I want you to report to your local police department is there's the availability for victim compensation here in New York State. It's called the Office of Victim Services of New York State. So you can work with any advocate, and every police department either has an advocate working for them or they know where to direct you to have a claim filed upon your behalf if you've in fact lost money to a crime of being defrauded by a scam.
Good information.
And what do you think, Nick, what do you think we do here at Lifespan?
Pretty much the same stuff. You're advocating
absolutely
for the people.
Yes, we do. And we are happy to help those victims. And we cover 12 counties. Basically, we cover the Finger Lakes region for victimization on scams for OVS claims here in New York State. Now, I see we're getting closer on time. Let me mention something that we should all be doing and something that has changed. And if you had the availability to join the listserv a year and a half ago at the FTC.gov, you'd know the rules changed regarding your credit reporting. credit reports are now available to everyone in the United States, and they used to be only once per year per agency. That's Experian, TransUnion, or Equifax. One report from each of those agencies per year. In other words, three reports a year. Right. No longer, Nick. Rules changed a year plus ago. You are now allowed one free credit report per credit agency per week.
Week. Wow.
That's the new rules. So that means you can go to annualcreditreport.com. That's annualcreditreport.com. And you can obtain your credit report for free online. It's super easy. If anyone has not done this in the last 6 months, then shame on you. Look at your credit. It's extremely important. Pull your credit report. Review it. Look for discrepancies. It's all about you, and it must be 100% accuracy about you. So if you see addresses on there that are addresses you've never lived at, you need to dispute them with that credit agency. So if you're on TransUnion's website and you pulled their credit report and you see an address that you've never lived at, you send a quick three-line letter to TransUnion, include a copy of your New York State driver's license, and you can get that disputed.
That's great. Dan, that's the best news and the best information. I can get a free credit report every week?
Every week.
I'm excited now.
All right, three.
Yeah, three times, right. So thank you so much, Dan. Thanks to you and to Lifespan for giving us the benefit of your expertise and your knowledge. I can't tell you how much we appreciate it.
Nick, want to thank you and Jazz 90.1 for having Lifespan on your channel. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm Nick Francesco for Soundbites on Member Supported, Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 49 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. Again, I want to thank Dan Lyon and the wonderful folks at Lifespan for providing us all this important information.
And he also goes around to libraries giving him this very important information. Yep.
Right. So if you're worried that you or someone you know may have been scammed, you can also find that information on our website at soundbites.org. It's the third link under some important links. Frauds and scams, the resources you need.
I just saw an episode of The Rookie this week with a new scam I hadn't heard of yet. One of the detective's mothers got tricked into signing her title over to a scammer because the scammer starts out with, you should put your house in a trust. Then that avoids a lot of the inheritance taxes and all that stuff, so your kids don't have to worry about that while you're mourning. Never said that I'm the trustee.
Right.
Then I sold the house and kicked you out.
Right. So, I want to go back and talk just a little bit about Doc Savage. It's a pulp magazine. It came out in the 20s, 30s. And it's a guy named Clark who is super strong and super smart. And has a fortress of solitude.
Is he the first superhero?
Many people think so.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say that this particular Clark with his fortress of solitude in the Arctic came out before the Superman comic book Clark with his fortress of solitude.
So he was 1933.
But it was only months before, but it was before.
Yeah.
It's a bunch of stories, and they're wonderful. And the basic premise was Street and Smith already had the Shadow, who was guns and shooting and all of that. And they wanted, it was the 30s, and it was science and technology, and they wanted a hero to do that stuff. So they went to Lester Dent. And he was very similar to Walter P. Gibson. He just said, "Yeah, I'll write him. Sure, I'm a pulp writer. I can write this stuff. Gibson had been an amateur magician. So in a lot of the shadow story, in some of the shadow stories, he knows how to get out of handcuffs, and he can get out of traps and all of that stuff. And much of that is based on really how it's done.
Yep.
So yeah, those were fun, and I've mentioned this before, but when I was a kid, there was a point when I was about 8 years old that I was very sick, and they thought I was going to die, and my father didn't know what to do, didn't know how to handle it, didn't know how to deal with it, but he knew I liked to read, so he went to a store and bought every paperback on the shelves. It didn't have a naked woman, a half-naked woman on the cover. So I got Doc Savage. I got The Shadow. I got John Carter of Mars. I got Tarzan. And I was at exactly the right age.
A mostly naked man.
Mostly naked man, right. my daughter, every time we're watching Reacher, and he takes his shirt off,
yep.
She goes, "Fan service."
Yep.
So I watched, I read all of those at exactly the right age. So those still speak to me. I still love them to this day.
They've been trying to do a movie version of him since the 30s, apparently.
Well, they did the Ron Ely or Eli, I don't care, version. The first half was excellent. The second half was horrible. Because the first half was pretty clean. And then they started winking at the audience, saying, "Yeah, we know we're camp."
There's a screenplay.
And it ruined it.
Yeah, a screenplay written by Philip Jose Farmer.
Yeah, he wrote a book that I think I would not encourage you to read. Where Tarzan and Doc Savage fight, and I'll tell you about that when we're off the air.
Arnold Schwarzenegger was attached to it at one point. Chris Hemsworth.
Chris Hemsworth was The Rock.
Dwayne Johnson, in 2016. Yeah, Dwayne Johnson
was, but they can't seem to get it written. And then there was the Alec Baldwin Shadow. There was a Shadow serial, I think more than one, back in the 40s, I guess, that was, Saturday morning serials. How popular were they? I guess it depended on what show they were in front of. Right, but yeah, so those were there, and the Alec Baldwin movie. I enjoyed the Alec Baldwin movie very much.
Wait a minute, that used to be a staple. You had, when you're having breakfast, to have the box of cereal in front of you, mm-hmm. so you could read everything on the front, the back, the side, the bottom, and you knew all the ingredients, too.
I'm talking about the other kind of cereal that you go to at the movies when you see it, you see chapters every week. Movie cereals, not breakfast cereals.
My mind went to food.
and you can find a lot of those online now. A lot of those are on YouTube. You can generally buy the DVDs of the serials put all together. You know, there was Rocket Men of the Stratosphere, which was had Leonard Nimoy in it. It was as a 20-year-old actor, it's hysterical.
I remember though back in the 50s. Early 50s, with the family growing up, and they, we didn't have TV then. We had the radio, and used to sit there and listen to the Lone Ranger, and
those were so great.
I mean, all those the Hornet or
the Green Hornet.
Yeah,
yeah.
Ma and Pa Kettle.
Ma and Pa Kettle were great. I have hundreds and hundreds of CDs with old time radio shows on them. I really have to break them out and rip them so that they're on something.
Yeah,
I'll buy a thumb drive for them. Those are wonderful things. Johnny Dollar, yours truly, Johnny Dollar,
and, mm-hmm.
Lots and lots of stuff. And those were staples back in those days.
Oh yeah,
and when the television came in, a lot of those were similar. You know, mm-hmm. A lot of the early stuff was one set, was set in a living room, and that's where it happened because that's the way it was. But then, you had Sky King.
And, Leave It to Beaver.
Leave It to Beaver and all of those things. Mom Pa Kettle, not Mom Pa Kettle.
No.
Fibber McGee and Molly was a TV show.
Sky well. King.
Sky King. Love Sky King. And Penny. Love Penny.
Rin Tin Tin.
Loved Rin Tin Tin. Sergeant Preston of the Yukon.
Yo.
Yeah.
Gilligan's Island's the first TV show I remember.
Shut up.
Paladin. Have Gun Will Travel.
Yeah, absolutely.
Bonanza.
Oh, yeah.
Bonanza was excellent.
Yeah, that was one of the longest-running series for Western.
Yeah, Gunsmoke beat it, but not by much. Maybe by much. But, yeah, Gunsmoke as well. And Gunsmoke started out as a radio series.
Mm-hmm. Lone Ranger.
Nero Wolf was a radio series. What a great bunch of books those were. Then they turned it into a radio series. Then there was a TV series with Timothy Hutton and Maury Chaykin. Which I love. I bought that. I ripped it. It's on my Plex server. I watch that semi-regularly.
That's how Gene Roddenberry got Star Trek sold. It was Wagon Train to the Stars.
Yep.
Because Wagon Train was so huge at the time. And he wrote for a lot of those early shows.
And those, talking about writers, those were guys who just walked in and said, sure, give me the Bible, I'll write a story. Just let me know what the characters are and what the. I don't have to be immersed in it. I don't have to live it. I write for a living. It's what I do. Boom, and they did it. All right, we are done for another week. I want to thank everybody who called in. What a far-ranging show we had this week. I particularly want to thank Mr. Dan Lyon and all the folks at Lifespan for their series of stuff. They were wonderful. I want to thank Dave Enright. I might as well thank Steve Ray sitting right here giving me the stink eye. I'm Nick Francesco. We will see you next week. Are you doing the thing again? Yeah. We'll see you in just 166 hours. Please, for gosh sake, be good to one another, will you? We'll see you next time.